from New York City. This is Jason Margolis, and this is Tech Podcast number 122. The World is a joint production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, public radio in Boston. All right, from all the noise in the background, you can no doubt surmise that I am not in the quiet confines of the studios of the World in Boston. I'm in Manhattan at the Wired Next Fest. That's Wired Magazine's annual gathering of all the newest and greatest and latest technologies. I'm in a massive pavilion surrounded by cars and plasma screens and devices whirling and twirling all around. So we're going to devote this tech podcast to the future of technology and the future of technology as presented in this room. There's about 150 exhibitors. So let's have a walk about and see what there is to see. So I should describe the room. I'm in New York City's Convention Center. And in this room, there are these large banners hanging with all the different types of displays. So there's the exploration banner, there is the green banner, there's design, there's health, communication, security, just to name a few. And then there's Robot Row. So why don't we start at Robot Row and find out exactly what the story is over there. So we're looking at a robot. It looks like a spaceman with the head of Einstein. Sir, tell me your name.
I'm Professor Jun Ho Oh from Korea.
From Korea?
Yes.
What, where in Korea?
Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology, KAIST in short.
Okay. Tell me what this is.
That is Android-type humanoid robot. That means it does have a human-like face, and the body is humanoid machine, so there is man in spacesuit.
I see. Why did you choose Einstein?
He's most popular person. Most of the person can recognize him all the world. So he's a very popular face. That's the only reason.
And can we see what the robot can do? Can you demonstrate?
He can walk. He can make gesture. He can make facial expression, and he can speak. Yeah, what else you can do? He can do.
Can you make him do something now, or is he being repaired?
This repairment now, battery exchange, and also the as you see that one belt is broken, just we found. So arm is not moving. Left arm is not moving. So we are trying to fix it now. We are going to physically fix this arm, not move. But the other part is moving. So okay. General demonstration is not a big problem.
Okay. That was too bad. Einstein doesn't seem to be working right now, but maybe we can come back and see a demonstration. But I have to tell you, just from looking at the face, it is truly remarkable. Just looks like a very well-done wax figure. Just very lifelike. I'm sure it's impressive. All right, here's another robot that looks quite interesting. Let's take a listen to what it can do. The robot... He's dressed as a flight attendant and a nurse and a guide. The advantage to this, I suppose, is that it can present information in a variety of languages. Very neat, incredibly lifelike. When I say incredibly lifelike, the eyes really look like a human being. Amazing. And the robot is very fashionably dressed.
Appearance with a slender and well-proportioned body, looks real with natural and smooth actions. Actroid is now used throughout the world when referring to realistic humanoid robots. The Actroid series debuted in November 2003. The development of the humanoid robots focusing on human characteristics created a big sensation at the International Robot Expo for its original approach and high quality. It requires both an internal and external developmental approach to create not only human-like movements, but also a realistic appearance. Recreation of soft and smooth skin, eyes with vitality, installation of highly specified functions, at the same time focusing on the exterior and not diminishing human-like features.
I'm back at the Wired Next Fest in New York City, and here is something that I just simply have to stop by and see. It's a robot that is serving cocktails. Let's go in for a closer peek.
Don't just stand there looking at me. Order something. My buddies all work in a factory. I've got the gravy job.
So, tell me what we're seeing here.
It's an automatic robotic bartender. It serves hundreds of recipes of drinks automatically. It has 64 ingredients, so that you can put 50 liquors and 60 or 14 mixers in it. And you can create a recipe that has any combination. You actually go to put a recipe on the screen. You call up, I want 1 ounce of vodka, 2 ounces of orange juice, 3 ounces of cranberry. And you put that recipe in there, and it'll make that drink every time, perfectly the same way every time.
And where is your, who makes this?
This is Motoman. We're a division of Yaskawa Electric, the largest industrial robot company in the world. We're the largest in the United States. And this is an industrial robot that was developed in Japan for putting car parts together. And we just applied it to this task. It's the only two-arm robot. So we put the two-arm robot to coordinate it together to pour drinks and mix drinks.
Is Yaskawa, that's in Japan?
Yaskawa's, yes, in Japan.
So can I order a drink?
Yes, you can.
So what are
you? Welcome to RoboBar.
Now we're just serving sodas and juices here. At the trade show, we were serving cocktails last night.
Okay. I came at the wrong time.
Okay.
So you said I could mix, though. Can I get an orange juice and a 7-Up? Is that possible?
Yeah, that's called a Sparkling Sunshine.
Okay.
So if we want to add that to the order, and you press make the drinks, and it'll make you a... that's the recipe for Sparkling Sunshine.
How about a beer?
Okay, so the robot is now grabbing a cup with the right hand. Very cool. So far, so good. It flips the cup over, and it goes over, pours me some ice.
You lost some weight lately?
It's giving me a compliment. It's putting in some 7-Up, is that correct?
7-Up and orange juice, yeah, mixed together. So it's going to pour a portion of each of those.
Welcome to RoboBar. Can I mix you a drink?
Set it down on the tray and deliver it to you.
So it's down on the tray, and the tray is sliding down. And there it is. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Very good.
Welcome to RoboBar.
And let me ask you really quick, what is the... seems like a lot of money to invest into a bartender. Why would you build a robot that can pour drinks?
Well, for instance, in a service bar in a casino like in Las Vegas,
you lost some weight
it's
lately?
7 days a week, 24 hours a day, so it's equivalent of 4 of our bartenders they're paying. This costs 30 cents an hour to operate. So it pays for itself in less than a year in that situation because it's making drinks. By the time you pay bartenders and all that. The other thing is it saves on liquor, on the inventory. All the free drinks that bartenders and the spills and the mistakes. About 20% of the liquor inventory in major bars and casinos is wasted, is thrown away. It's kind of written off as lost inventory. This saves a lot on that. So when you've got a couple $100,000 of liquor being poured in one bar per year, it's going to save you 20% of that. So it's even more savings in that.
And have you sold any of these?
Yes, we have. We have actually in Dubai, we have units that are making everything that Starbucks does with coffees, cappuccinos, lattes, in addition to mixed drinks. And in Germany, we've sold one over there. And actually going to London now, we have some going over to London.
Amazing. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Okay,
thanks for the drink. Okay, I'm going to need a little break now to drink my beverage. So I'm going to play for you a story that I did this week on our program, on our radio program. And it's about surgery in outer space. Well, not really, but surgeons in France who are simulating zero gravity conditions to see if surgery in outer space would be possible.
The plane soared high above France, climbing up and zooming down like a roller coaster.
It did this for 3 hours. Each time the plane went into freefall, it simulated zero gravity conditions for 22 seconds. The pilot performed 32 of these maneuvers, giving surgeons on board enough time to remove a benign cyst from a patient's forearm. The patient, Philippe Sanchot, was chosen because he's an avid bungee jumper and is accustomed to dramatic gravitational shifts. The zero-gravity surgery had obvious challenges, said Pierre Vaida. He's head of aerospace medicine at the Bordeaux Hospital. He was in charge of today's experiment.
The difference with operation on Earth is that everything can float. For example, scalpels and other instruments put on magnetic systems, they will be fixed by magnetic forces.
The surgical team and the patient were tethered to the floor with harnesses. Chief Surgeon Dominique Martin said it was a disorienting experience.
In fact, you don't know exactly where you are, if your head is up or down, and you must try to avoid, in fact, this sensation, because sensations are quite different, and you could have problems with your surgical movements, particularly if you have precise surgical movement to perform.
As for why today's operation was conducted, scientists hope the experiment may help make it possible for astronauts to travel farther for longer periods, possibly making prolonged visits to the moon or to Mars. Dr. Warren Sandberg leads the Center of Integration of Medicine and Innovative Technologies at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
To send people safely into space for long periods of time and still be able to offer them the option of surgical treatment for common problems that would crop up in astronauts, things like injuries or even appendicitis, we're going to have to master a lot of techniques that are very easy to do in gravity.
Today's procedure was considered relatively simple. Still, Sandberg says it was a big breakthrough, though he adds medical teams still have much to learn.
There are teams working on how to provide anesthesia, including controlling the airway and providing artificial breathing for astronauts. And even such simple techniques as starting an IV become quite challenging in microgravity. And then if you get into the vein and there's a little bit of bleeding, even a drop of blood will just drift off.
It's difficult to estimate how far off surgery in space is from becoming a reality. But with today's successful experiment, the days of Dr. McCoy on Star Trek are feeling less and less like science fiction. All right, I'm back at the Wired Next Fest, and I'm enjoying my cocktail poured by my robotic bartender. It's actually not a cocktail. It's 7-Up and orange juice, but it's delicious nonetheless. Actually, it's a little more orange juice than I like, but that's okay. So we're going to walk over now to the next area. All right, now we're at the Invenio exhibit, and I'm here with Kristen Peterson. Kristen, tell me what we're looking at here. What is Invenio doing with your technology? Specifically, you're doing some work in the Philippines. Tell me about that.
What we're providing is an ultra-low power computer that is connected back to a main village with long-distance Wi-Fi, and it also is connecting a telephone to that system so that they can get access to the internet and they can get access to telephony. It's in Mindanao, southern Philippines. And what we'll be doing is working with an organization in that area who provides agricultural extension offices to local farmers. In fact, they're seaweed farmers. And the goal of that project is to provide better information to those farmers for them to get access to information to improve their crops and also to get better at connection for those farmers to talk to their customers.
So how do some of these villagers, like these seaweed farmers, how do they get Wi-Fi in what I imagine is a fairly remote part of the world? You know, unlike if I go to my Starbucks and I can just dial up the Wi-Fi, how are you bringing them Wi-Fi to these remote corners of the world?
We go to a main village in the area and connect to the internet in one of three ways. We either use local regular internet like we have here, or we use internet that comes over the cell phone network, Or we use internet that comes over the satellite network, but that's very expensive. So we try and use the most cost-effective internet access that there is possible. What we do then is once we get internet to that one location, we help by using long-distance Wi-Fi to bring that out to many locations in the area. So they can all the different farmers in the different locations can go to their agricultural extension offices and all get access to that same one point of the internet very cost-effectively, so they can all share it.
So essentially you have one hub then, if I'm understanding correctly, you have one hub for the internet and then you spread it out throughout the village through Wi-Fi. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, we go to one regional village where there's internet access. And then what we do is we use wireless technology to extend that internet access out to other more rural, smaller villages. And we put very low power computers there that can access that internet that can be run either by local electricity power or with solar power, any local grid power, because many of these villages don't have electricity.
And how does solar play into all of this? You're going to be using solar, is that correctly, or you are using it?
In the Philippines, we'll be using grid power because they have grid power available. But in many villages around the world, in developing countries, there is very little access to power. And so what's important is that we have other ways than just regular grid power or electricity to power the computers. And so we can use solar, we can use microhydro, which is water power, we can use wind power, we can even use, in backup cases, other options.
You know, NVIDIA is based in San Francisco, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and it's inveneo.com.org?
.org.
Okay, great. And so we were talking about the Philippines. Where else are you doing some projects?
We're doing projects in four other countries right now. We started out in Uganda. We've got several projects there in schools and economic development programs. We also are in Rwanda, in Ghana, and we've got a very small project in Haiti.
Okay, so I'm talking now with Laura Mello, who is the Chief Operating Officer of NVIDIA. And so, Laura, a question for you. What happens if I'm in my small village in the Philippines or wherever and something breaks down and my IT help is 8,000 miles away in San Francisco? How do I deal with that?
Your IT help is actually going to be local to you. It may be in the next village over or the large city in your country. Because Invenio is dedicated to knowledge transfer. A big part of our program is to take the information that we have and transfer it to technology professionals in the country so that they're able to support projects that we deploy, as well as have access to the tools that we've developed so that they can deploy projects themselves in country. So they'll be able to answer your cry for help.
And Laura, what is this we're looking at right here? Is this explain to me what this is.
Okay, so what this in front of us is the solar panel, which powers the system, as well as the access point, which is for the Wi-Fi signal, so that it can communicate with another antenna in the next village over, and that's how we transfer the connectivity from village to village.
And Laura or Kristen, do you want to tell me some of the benefits that, going back to the Philippines example, that these seaweed farmers are going to get from having internet access? What are the practical benefits? I don't imagine they're going to be doing the same things I do on the internet.
Well, they're actually going to have computer access, internet access, and telephony access. And so there are a number of benefits. If you can imagine yourself as a rural farmer, a seaweed farmer, if you can go into your agricultural office and get more information about how better to grow your seaweed, you can increase your yield by perhaps 2-3 times. And so perhaps you can go and read some information on the computer, you can go on the internet, or if you can't read, you can actually listen to a radio show or play a video on how better to improve your crops. So that can make a world of difference to these farmers, because that can mean that they can make that much more money with their greater yield, so that perhaps they can, instead of having their kids work on their farm, they can send their kids to school.
Great. And so the project hopefully will be getting started in November, we're hoping.
We hope it'll be started in November.
Okay, great. And hopefully I'll be there in November with you. So
we hope so too.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Men and tales, times I tried to save the world, never made sense of it all. I read about old Nottingdale, I did my time in the county jail, but I never did land too far from home. Yeah. Loved and laughed, I cried, that you could see.
All right, I'm walking around the Wired Next Fest right now, and one very interesting project is the Portable Light Project. And essentially what that's doing is it's taking solar panels that people can wear on themselves, and then they can transform this unit, this sheet that they're wearing, and it turns into a light. And this is being tried down in Mexico. So I'm standing next to Sheila Kennedy, who is in charge of the project. So Sheila, tell us what we're seeing here.
We are looking at prototypes of the Portable Light Project that are textile-integrated energy harvesting and light-emitting devices for off-the-grid electrification and lighting.
Okay, so explain to me what that is in layman's terms for those of us who aren't engineers.
Well, you're probably familiar with solar technology, and when we think about solar technology, we usually think about silicone-based, glass-based, heavy, stiff pieces that are fragile. And what we've done is work with a manufacturer who has a different nanotechnology which allows the solar panels to be thin and flexible.
So you're holding a flexible, can I call it a sheet of?
Yeah, I think that I think calling it a sheet is very fair. In fact, what we tried to do was make the design as simple as possible.
So this sheet, which side of it captures the solar and generates that into electricity?
The outer side captures the sunlight and harvests energy. And that can be folded up very small and integrated into a carry bag or just put out in the sun. And in about 2.5 hours, sunlight will produce enough electricity to run the lights for 9 hours at night.
So someone could have this on, as you were telling me, on a poncho or a bag, and then at the end of the night, it converts from a solar gathering panel into a light.
That's right. There are semiconductors that have two simple gate functions. And I know this is a little bit technical, but think about them as gates. One is a gate that takes sunlight and turns into electricity, and the other one is a gate that takes just a little bit of electricity and turns that back into light. So this design enables those two gates to occur. So we collect the sun's energy through the solar panels on the outer side, convert that into electricity, store it in a rechargeable battery, which is also integrated into the textile, and then we use that energy with the two high-brightness LED light sources.
And who will be benefiting from this? Who's going to use this?
So we have two pilot projects for portable light right now. One is in Mexico in the Sierra Madre Mountains, which are very rugged, very remote mountains. And then we have a project that we're just starting to work on in the northern part of Queensland in Australia with the Aboriginal community there.
And tell me about these people who live in Mexico. What's their lifestyle like? Why would they need light? Why would they need a product like this?
Well, where they live, there's absolutely no electricity. This is an extremely rugged territory, which is characterized by really deep gorges and steep mountains. And then the Huichol, or Wixarica, as they're called, are an indigenous group that's really semi-nomadic. That means they travel a lot. They travel to different parts of the Sierra, depending on whether it's wet or rainy or dry season. They travel on pilgrimages. They travel to cities to try to sell their goods, and they're on the move quite a bit. So being tied to a village with a fixed centralized infrastructure somewhere in the flatlands or the foothills really takes them away from their culture and from the lands which they've traditionally owned for 1,000 years or more.
And how many times have you been down there so far?
I've been down there. I go down there at least twice a year, and we've been working on this project for about 3 years.
Okay. And then you'll go back down in January to see how they're doing. Is that correct?
Yes, we'll go down in January, and we'll be making periodic evaluations every couple of months to make any necessary repairs, see what works and what doesn't work.
And how many people are using this? Are we talking dozens or hundreds or thousands?
Hundreds of people are using this, and it's providing direct benefits for a community of more than 800 people.
So now these right here, if we can pick them up, they are these are the actual lanterns. They collect the light, the solar light, and then they turn into lanterns later. Would this actually be worn by someone during the day, so it's collecting solar electricity as they're hiking along or moving from one location to the next?
This could be worn by someone, but as we were working with the Huichol community, we realized that by creating a different type of garment, it would also kind of point to the user in a way that seemed to be negative. So instead, this can be folded and just placed over a bag, which is then turned to the back. So since they carry these bags all the time, the traditional clothing doesn't have pockets, it's very simple for them to just charge as they walk along roads or as they work on their ranchos, which are their small farms.
So right now we see a video of someone who's reading. How much light could I, practically speaking, get from this? Is it enough to read? Could I do? Could I cook a meal at night? Could I make pottery, as I've seen in some of these videos?
The technical answer is we're producing more than 90 lumens of light, and usually you can read with about 40 lumens of light. So it's a very bright light.
And for people listening in other parts of the world, where is the Sierra Madre? Where are these people of these videos we're looking at right now?
Well, you can think about Mexico as having being bordered, in essence, by a triangle with two mountain ranges. And the Sierra Madre is the mountain range on the west that actually extends all the way up to our own Sierras. It's part of the same geography, essentially. And the community is in remote parts of five different states, mostly in Jalisco State, but also in Zacatecas, Nayarit, and Durango.
And the team is heading down to Mexico in December or January to see how the project is going, and hopefully I'm going to be able to accompany them.
Escuta minha história morena. Nos meus sonhos só te vejo a ti. Tu passaste a ser obsessão pra mim. É maravilhoso amar. É uma maravilha estar enamorado. Escuta minha história morena. Te encontrar foi pra mim sonho. No meu combate pela vida, perdi a noção das
coisas. Alright, I'm now walking around in the play and entertainment areas, and looks like there's a game of air hockey being played. However, it's all digital. There's no actual puck. There's no actual air. It's just a simulation, and kids are whacking the puck with their hands. Pretty cool. Over in the world of entertainment, lots of plasma screens. There is a man in a large sphere wearing some type of goggles that I assume create some virtual reality. He looks like he is about to stumble and fall as they're twirling the sphere. Lots of plasma screens with incredibly crisp definition. There's a game being played called Brain Ball, and two young women have sensors attached to their foreheads, and they are willing the ball across the table with their brain waves. Oh, here's a better description. In Brain Ball, two players sit across a special table wearing the sport's hallmark brainwave detecting headbands. The headbands monitor each player's stress level, indicating alpha and theta waves, and report the data to a computer that directs the ball away from the stress and towards the calm. There's another young man. He seems to be paddling down a river in a kayak. However, of course, he's not in a river, nor is he in a kayak. But He is looking at this all on a video screen, and the video is picking up the movements of his arms as he's holding an oar, which is connected to some sensors. All right, let's go over and talk to a few more people here at the Next Fest. I'm walking over to the Security Pavilion, the future of security. We're over at now at the Security Pavilion, and I'm talking with Tim Heffernan, who works for Symbol Technologies, and he's going to tell me about the boarding pass of the future. Yes. So what is the boarding pass of the future?
Okay, so basically what we've done is integrated a boarding pass with an RFID chip. So inside your boarding pass will now be a RFID chip and antenna that contains a unique identifier very similar to a license plate that's on the back of your car that is then associated with a biometric, your face, that is a picture that is taken at when you print out the boarding pass at the kiosk. So if you think about what does this solve? It solves two things. One, that long line that we all have to wait in post 9/11 that verifies that it's your license matched to this boarding pass name. And it solves a security threat. Now, if you think about the way boarding passes are printed now, where, let's say for argument's sake, that my friend is a sleeper and I'm a terrorist, right? So he goes and buys a ticket online, prints it out at home, and then we take that printed version, we white out the name, put my name on, photocopy it. Now I have a quote-unquote real boarding pass. I take my fake ID that's associated with that name, I walk up to the security thing, the security agent dutifully checks that my fake ID name matches my fake name on my boarding pass, and I walk through security, right? And my friend walks through as well. After we get through security, he hands me his boarding pass, and I walk onto the plane.
And how far off is this technology from being a reality? Or, I mean, is the technology already perfected?
The technology is perfected. This is the first time we're demonstrating it this week. Pieces of this system is already being used, such as at McCarran International Airport in Las Vegas. They're using our technology for baggage tags.
Now, you have some demonstrations here. Do you want to show me what you have?
We have a mock security gate that has the whole entire system set up with an RFID reader and antennas and the camera, and that then matches to a screen that shows that it's verifying that it's my face and my baggage tag that's going through. Over here, we are showing our new forklift reader. So this mounts onto a forklift and can read all the tags that are going through a DC or a warehouse.
Now, probably a dumb question, but do I get one of these at the kiosk each time I take a flight, or how does that work?
Each time you take a flight, you'd have two places that you could pick up your boarding pass. One would be the kiosk, the other one would be the ticket counter, or the outside one where you could check your bags outside. So there would be a kiosk, you'd enter in information, you'd take your picture as you're entering this information, out would pop your boarding pass, and that's how you get onto the flight.
Oh, you have to have your picture taken for each flight, is that?
For each flight, yes.
I see. So then they see when you're getting on the...
Right. It does not
I'm kind of slow, I see.
Right. It doesn't keep your image forever. It dumps it after the flight takes off, so that way there aren't any privacy or security concerns.
I see. Now, is this just a mock-up, or does it actually do anything?
No, it does.
And I'm pointing at the gate for people in radio land who can't see where I'm pointing.
Right. The gate has... when you walk through the gate, it reads your RFID boarding pass. The camera then is looking to match the face that it's seeing with the boarding pass that it sees.
Can you or I walk through this? Can you walk
sure.
through? So Tim is about to walk through with his boarding pass, and I will narrate. So there's a camera mounted on top of the gate that he's about to enter. And it's taken a picture of him. And so tell me what's going to happen here. So the camera is going to take your picture.
The camera is going to look for my picture and look to match the retinas and the distance of my eyes. So with the EPC solution software, that's what it does. That's how it matches the face that it took the picture at the kiosk with the face that's supposed to match on this boarding pass. It then says, okay, it's supposed to match Tim's face. And let me see if it matches that face. And it's going to give you a green light or red light telling you, yes, it matches, no, it doesn't. There you go. It just did it while we're standing here. See, I looked up, and there's my image and picture, and it all green lighted.
And then what about security concerns with RFID? I know there's been a lot of hubbub about the RFID on passports, for example.
The only information that you're getting off of this chip passport's different, but the only information you're getting off this chip is a unique identifier that is very analogous to what's on the back of your license plate of your car. So just like you're not worried about anybody stealing your ID because you have a license plate in your car, nor should you be worried about an RFID chip getting your information. The other thing is, what I'm demonstrating now is when I hold up this tag, you can see a yellow light on the reader saying it's reading. See the green light, yellow light. Now watch when I put it next to my body. It goes away. Why? Because I'm a big sack of water. We're all big sacks of water. And water is a detuner for RF. So I'm going to walk all the way up to it, and you're going to see that it's not going to read.
Okay, he was right. Okay.
Great.
So what have I learned from that?
What you've learned is that this is a very bad technology if you were trying to track you from space or something, because it does not work that way. It's an authentication technology, not so much a tracking technology. It authenticates that I'm Tim Heffernan holding this boarding pass. We call them safety tags, protection of the food supply, drug supply, and when you travel.
All right, I think that's going to do it for me here in New York City at the Wired Next Fest convention. Made it through about 10 or 15 exhibits, and there's about 135 more to go. Don't think I'm going to have time to get to all of them. Certainly not time to present all of them to you. So thanks for listening, and I'll be speaking to you again next week back in Boston. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. El pollo que tiene al lado te hace llover.